So hey guys, welcome back. We have another one for you. And today we have a great guest on the phone. We have Brent Rogers on the phone. Brent has written a book called Buffalo Bill and the Mormons. We're going to be talking about the book and the history of Buffalo Bill and his relationship with the Mormons. But before we do so, I want to thank my friends at the Tombstone Epitaph, one of Arizona's longest running newspapers. You can subscribe and have the epitaph delivered right to your door by going to tombstoneepitaph.com. I want to thank my second family at Wild West History Association, at wildwesthistory.org. Be sure to go over there and check them out. They've got tons of history, including our Fort Smith, our Roundup 2024 in Fort Smith, Arkansas, and we'd love to see you there. Please join. It's great. They have a new membership for $60. You get the journal delivered right to your email. So if you are living abroad, living somewhere overseas, and shipping and getting the journal is too much, or you want it in a digital format so you can read like I do. I have it now as a digital format. I can read it on the go, when I'm at the airport, when I'm flying, like wherever I'm at and I have internet service, I can read the journal and get Western history right to my phone. And you can do so by going to wildwesthistory.org. And then also the guys over at BTK Coalition, all things Billy the Kid at btkcoalition.com. They got a great membership there. They got some cool stuff going on. So you want to check out what they're doing at btkcoalition.com and then see they've got all sorts of stuff and then a membership. Go check them out. It's all things Billy the Kid at btkcoalition.com. So today's podcast is brought to us through our mutual friends over at University of Nebraska Press. Sarah Key, I can't thank her enough for the continued support. And everybody over at University of Nebraska Press, not only is this book that we're going to talk about today published by UNP, but also a lot of the podcasts. And Sarah Key is doing a great job. She's super helpful. So thank you, Sarah. Yay, Sarah. Thank you, Sarah, for connecting Brent and I together. Now, if you want to find out about Buffalo Bill and the Mormons, go on Amazon. The book is selling for about $30. It's actually $29.63. I don't know how they come up with that 63 cents, but it's $29.63 on Amazon. The book was put out in March 2024. It's about 312 pages. And according to the info on Amazon, there's 22 photos and all sorts of stuff. The photos are crisp and clear. And there's also some pictures in there of Buffalo Bill, handbills for the plays and the stuff that he wrote. Really fantastic stuff. So if you want to get the book, which I urge you to do so, go on Amazon. And you can also go on booksellers near you. That's fine too. But Amazon seems to be the place for books today. And it's reselling or selling for $29.63. So today we have Brent Rogers on the phone. Welcome, Brent.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, man. You're a busy, busy guy. So I'm going to read a little bit about Brent because he is no slouch. Like, Brent's just not hanging out at Foster's Freeze eating ice cream, just cranking out a book. This guy's, he's got it together. He's an historian and a documentary editor for the Joseph Smith Papers. He's earned his bachelor's degree with honors from San Diego State University. He has an MA in public history from California State University, Sacramento, and a PhD with emphasis in 19th century United States history from the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. He's also the author of A Distinction Between Mormons and Americans, Mormon Indian Missionaries, The Federal Indian Policy and the Utah War, also Utah Historical Quarterly, which won, it says here, which won the Western History Association's 2015 Arrington, I'm going to say this, I'm going to butcher this, Arrington Prucha Prize, is that right?
I think it's Pruka, but Pruka. Close enough.
Okay, prize for the best article on the history of religion in the West. His first monograph on popular sovereignty, Mormons and the Federal Management of Early Utah Territory, is, well, this was in 2017, so it's out by now. He's also the co-editor of journals 3, May 1843 to June 1844 in the Joseph Smith Papers, Salt Lake City Church and the Historian's Press. I mean, he's got it all going on. I mean, what are you not doing? Are you, like, not changing transmissions on 63 Buicks? Or, like, what are you not doing? Or are you doing that, too? Yeah.
No, auto repair is definitely not one of my fortes. So definitely not auto repair or anything really handy. You know, I can't. I tried to make some shelves in my garage once, and they're still standing, but boy, they don't look very good.
But they're still standing.
They are still standing, and they're still holding. They're still holding the bins and boxes and all the things.
So you're a busy man, because tell us a little bit about you. Are you currently, I'm going to say, I don't really know exactly. Do you work for the church, or are you with BYU? What are you doing?
Yeah, I work for the church history department of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. In the division in which I work, we have, I want to say around 40 historians that work in the department. And I have been, in the last 6 or 7 years, managing a team of historians to work on the Joseph Smith papers, to get all of Joseph Smith's written record out and accessible and available to the public. And we do that both in book form and on our website at josephsmithpapers.org. So anyone interested in wanting to know more about Joseph Smith, about his documentary record, about all of the texts that we have from his lifetime, we have all of those available on our website. And, you know, the work that we do is to, I guess, accessibility is the big part there. We want to make sure that we get accurate transcripts with contextual and textual annotation that helps people understand the documents. We provide historical introductions that are written based on intense research that we do. So it's a very large and involved public history project that's been going on in earnest since the early 2000s. And just last year, we published our last of the print edition, and we're still working on completing the web offering, because there are just so many documents, we couldn't get them all into print. And with the accessibility that the web provides, we wanted to make sure we focused on getting a complete edition, and that's done online.
But you mentioned a website, so what is the website?
It is josephsmithpapers.org.
Josephsmithpapers.org.
Yep.
Gotcha. So you're growing up, I'm not sure where you grew up. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in a, well, not a super small town, I guess, but a town just east of Sacramento named Cameron Park. So it's in the foothills of the Sierra Nevadas. Mm-hmm. I lived there until I was 18, and it was more like until I was about 20, and then I moved down to San Diego and did my undergrad down in San Diego State before moving back up to Sacramento, and then to Lincoln, Nebraska, and then here to Salt Lake City, Utah. Cool. But yeah, Cameron Park was a great place to grow up, and we had family that were in Nebraska. My mom's side of the family is from the Omaha, Nebraska area, and then my dad's side of the family was kind of from more all over, but had ties in Kansas, Nebraska, and Arkansas mostly. And so we would, you know, as a youngster, I would go with my dad and take some road trips, hit Interstate 80, go all the way to Nebraska, and then go down to Kansas and Arkansas. And so we had a lot of, at least a half a dozen big road trips like that. And my dad would always stop along the way at historic sites. And I specifically remember stopping in North Platte and going to Buffalo Bill Cody's Scouts Rest Ranch, and just having that be a very fond early memory of my childhood.
So it almost sounds like dad instilled in you that love of history to where you, when you graduated and did you do a mission?
No, I didn't.
Okay. So you went out of high school and then you graduated and you were traveling. So he instilled this sense of history, Western history, from your father, sounds like.
Yeah, I would say so. The one thing that I always appreciated about my dad and, you know, that as I've grown and had children and my wife's family does, you know, traveling and road trips a lot differently than they're you get in the car and you get there as fast as you can kind. And so my dad was very much let's explore, let's find what we can find along the way. And he was always stopping off at old historic sites. Nice. And I have a lot of the pictures and like I said, good memories of being at some of those sites and remembering that as something that definitely instilled in me an interest in wanting to know more about these places that I was traveling to, the people that lived there. And yeah, I think my dad has can take a lot of credit for helping me to enjoy and find an even greater interest in history from the times that we spent traveling during those early years in my life.
Well, I mean, plus two, you lived in Sacramento, and I know Sacramento area fairly well. I mean, you're close to Donner Summit and the Donner Party, and you're close to the gold rush, and you're close to the history, you know, up in the Sonoma area. Like, you were surrounded by it growing up. You didn't even have to go that far.
No, there was, you know, fourth grade California history was one of my favorite classes in elementary school. And you know, we talked about it, the things that you talk about, the gold rush, the Donner Party, California missions, the mission system. And you know, that was one of my favorite classes in elementary school. And then I spent, you know, time going and exploring a lot of those sites over the years, especially as I was then able to, you know, drive myself and then go exploring on my own. And one of my favorite places is the gold discovery site. And, you know, 7 or 8 years ago or so, I drove my kids out there and took them to see some of the sites that I was used to going to as a kid, you know, and then go into Sacramento, and you can go to Sutter's Ford and Old Sacramento to the Great Railroad Museum that's there. It's just a fantastic place for engaging with, you know, the Western past.
So you're moving forward. Brent's living life. He's getting degrees. He's making a name for himself. He's, you know, I mean, you're doing all these wonderful things. When did you decide that you're like, man, I've got all this stuff in my head and access in front of me, and I want to be an author. I want to write books. Was it by accident? How did you become an author?
Well, so when I was working on my master's degree at California State University, Sacramento, or Sacramento State, I had the opportunity to apply for an internship with the California State Archives. And one of the interview questions was, you know, what do you want to do with a history degree? I mean, and at the time, I really wanted to be an archivist, just being able to engage with and to sort and organize, to process collections of historical documents was really a thrill to me. I got this interview there, and I remember them asking me that, and I talked about wanting to be an archivist, but then I sort of surprised myself by saying, and you know, I want to write about history, because I didn't consider myself to be a very strong writer. But there's something that's really connected, right, about gaining knowledge over all of these record collections that you're getting to work with and then trying to describe them. I mean, part of the archivist's job is to help historians or help researchers or, you know, help whoever is looking into the past find what wonderful nuggets of history are in these collections. And doing that requires writing. And so you're already doing some writing, but taking it to another level of, you know, not just describing collections of documents, but seeing the connectivity in them and with other collections of documents and with other, you know, other histories that have been written. And there was something that I was really interested about, trying to figure out these puzzle pieces, right? So you have that sort of singular, well, it is not singular, right? Because collections of records can be quite large. But if you look at just the collection level, figuring that out, and then thinking about how that collection of documents about a person, a place, an organization, event, what have you, and how that might connect to other trends of history, that got my brain going about how can this be one puzzle piece in a larger puzzle. And I started thinking more about the larger puzzle. But it was during that interview that I don't know if it dawned on me or, but that was what I came away from that interview thinking, wow, I'd really, really would like to write more history and not just do the archival work. And I got the internship. I got the position for, it was about a year and a half that I got to work at the California State Archives and got to look at some really awesome collections on, from the State Water Rights Board, from a variety of senators, state senators, that is, and just different California government organizations. And you know, being every little piece kind of helped me think more and more about, you know, these larger trends of history, you know, and like the Water Rights Board one, you know, the importance of water in the West, which I don't know if, like, you know, as a 20-year-old kid, you know, maybe totally appreciate that, the importance of of water, but like the depth of the history and how important water is in the West, like that was when I really engaged with that in a way that I had never thought about. And again, so all these things just started, I don't know if you want to say piling up, or I just started thinking about them in a more collective way, and how I could understand all of these things in a larger framework. And so I think that's kind of where I decided that I wanted to write. And once I decided I wanted to write more, I kind of thought that I probably ought to go get a PhD. Exactly. I talked to my advisor at Sacramento State. Her name was Dr. Lee Simpson, and she was just a fantastic mentor, and she helped me think a little bit more about an even more advanced degree beyond the master's degree. And then also a professor named Dr. Joseph Pitti. I took his California history and American West classes, and he was the, you know, him and Dr. Simpson were the two professors that really saw potential in me, or at least they verbalized that they saw potential in me as a writer. And like I said, I didn't consider myself to be a really strong writer. And so to get that type of encouragement, and Dr. Pitti even writing on one of my papers that he handed back, and he said, you know, something to the effect of, I don't have the exact quote, but this is PhD level writing, you know, good job. And so that was really meaningful to me. It made me, you know, have some confidence in myself to be able to maybe take that on. And so I applied to PhD programs and was fortunate to get accepted by a couple of schools. And the University of Nebraska offered me a nice scholarship. And I decided to go there, both because they had a really strong American West program, and they had this emerging digital history program that was really appealing to me from some of my my interest in kind of keeping my foot in the public history field. And so at Sacramento State, I emphasized my studies in public history and the work in a digital realm at the University of Nebraska, and to connect that with my interest in the American West just seemed like a really great fit. And so when they offered me scholarship and ability to come there, it just seemed like the right place to be. And so I went to Lincoln, and that was where, you know, things really started to take off, because before too long I was working with Doug Seafeld, who was a professor of American Western history at Nebraska at the time. He was working with the papers of Buffalo Bill Cody at the Buffalo Bill Historical, Buffalo Bill Center of the West. And I got an opportunity to help, you know, contribute to that project and to work on the papers of William F. Cody. And so Doug, Dr. Seafeld, he kind of hooked me up with these folks. You know, he knew I had an interest in the West. I had this interest in documents and documentary history and textual records, and it was just a really good connection. He then introduced me to some key people at the Buffalo Bill Center of the West, in particular Kurt Graham and Jeremy Johnston, and they were really they really embraced me and helped support me and my interest in Buffalo Bill. And so it was all these things sort of built on one another, I guess. And I feel like I'm rambling at this point, but is that get you to where you want to be?
Yeah, because that it's kind of the gateway into your book. Your book is called Buffalo Bill and the Mormons. You can find it at Amazon for $29.63. It's out now, so go ahead and order. I just looked at Amazon, and they said they had like 19 books left, but they're going to order more. So that's a good thing. Going to keep that book flowing and getting out to folks who want to learn more about Buffalo Bill and the Mormons. When I read your book, and I'm, like I said, I'm not done with it, but when I was reading it, the first chapter was really interesting, and without going real long into it, you wrote about the history of the church leaving Illinois and coming west and coming into the Great Salt Lake Valley. It's written in such a way that it's like it's our the words that we use today. It's more of a modern a modern historical account of the church moving west. Was that something that you had always wanted to do in any of your books, was to tell that story? Because you told the story, and then you got into Buffalo Bill and the Mormons.
Yeah, well, it's not, I guess, that I, you know, that was a story that I really wanted to tell. I think it was a story that I felt that I needed to tell for this book. You know, I named that first chapter Setting the Stage because I felt like it was really important to set this context, this background to the church and its people and Buffalo Bill and to show people how and why I see these early connections and intersections and how they come to influence and impact what then comes in the later chapters. And that was, it struck me that way when, you know, as I'm starting to write, and Buffalo Bill's birth is coinciding with the departure of Latter-day Saints from Nauvoo to the West. And it's happening in a space that's pretty close, where the Codys are living in LeClaire, Iowa, on the Mississippi River, is not really all that far away from Nauvoo. And with Buffalo Bill's dad's Isaac's work, you know, he would have been involved in some ways in knowing the story of the Mormons, as would a lot of people of the river towns in Iowa and like the upper Mississippi, you know, around Illinois at the time. And so I saw that as kind of the first connection point that Buffalo Bill is born at the same time that Latter-day Saints are actively leaving the boundaries of the United States to move to the Great Basin. And so I really wanted to tell the story in a way that helped to set up the rest of the story, because it to me, it makes good sense. Like, you got to talk about the things that the church went through and then understand how they were perceived, because perception is a huge part of the story of Buffalo Bill and the Mormons, how the people of the United States and how the American culture perceived Latter-day Saints, and then therefore how Buffalo Bill perceived the Latter-day Saints, and then what the Saints went through, and how there are sort of these connection points that help tell the story. Like when you know, we talk about Buffalo Bill being a young boy and being out on an outing with his dad, and the wagon trains are going across. By this point, the Codys are in near Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, but there's still wagon trains going across. And Isaac Cody is telling his son about the differences in the people, including, you know, these Mormons who he very strongly urges his son to stay away from, and why that would be the case, you know, to explain why that would be the case. And then to explain why, you know, in 1879, when Buffalo Bill writes his first autobiography, or has, you know, someone help him write his first autobiography, why that's like a core memory that goes into his writing of it. Like why he talks about that specific instance of seeing, you know, a Mormon wagon train and Mormons burying their dead because they were seen as these diseased peoples who were, you know, catching cholera and moving on along the path, but to stay away from the Mormon wagon trains. You know, that warning to a young child is, you know, it seems to have been something that was a core memory for Buffalo Bill, and that he felt needed to be added into his autobiography, which again, I think is an interesting connection. And so I wanted to really just use this as a way to set up the story that comes.
But as the book progresses, talk about the relationship between, and it may not have been a relationship, it may have been the way that Buffalo Bill felt about the Mormons. Because it, from what I read, it wasn't a good view.
No, it's not a good view. And that's I think, owing to the popular perception in American culture at the time. I mean, you have Latter-day Saints are seen as these very reviled people, practitioners of plural marriage, which is seen in a very negative light, seen as, you know, this twin relic of barbarism in the 1850s and beyond, where you have the other relic being slavery. And while there's debate, right, and then a civil war that goes on around slavery, it was pretty universally despised, plural marriage was. And so there's very strong negative perceptions about who Latter-day Saints were as a people. And that, I think, influences, like, it saturated American culture at the time. And I think it influenced Cody in his viewpoint of Latter-day Saints. And so when he gets to this stage of his career where he's performing, you know, he's getting people, Ned Blentline, writing performances for him, they take that negativity, that terrible perception of Mormons, and make them the villains in these stories that that Buffalo Bill is the star of, right? And thereby endorses that messaging of Latter-day Saints as very vile and reviled peoples. And that's a major part of how Buffalo Bill's stage career gets launched is by these anti-Mormon plays in the 1870s. And this is the time in which you're almost to the height of anti-Mormonism in America. That comes in the 1880s, but it's growing a very large amount at this time in the 1870s. And, you know, so positioning Cody as the hero against these Mormon villains. And it's not just Mormons. There's other villains of American culture at the time. He's fighting against Native peoples who were seen as a threat to American expansion in the West. There's Irishmen who are part of this band of miscreants in Cody's early plays. They're a negatively perceived group in American culture at the time. And you get the sense that Cody is both playing on that perception and profiting from it. And so that it's a lucrative genre, positioning him as this hero against these un-American threats, and the Mormons being one of those. And by 1877, when he performs May Cody, the May Cody play, they are the main villains, the Latter-day Saints are. Brigham Young is a character in the play, and this is coming right after the John D. Lee trials for the Mountain Meadows Massacre, and Buffalo Bill is, you know, described as the man who is defending, you know, the wagon train against Mormons as a boy in 1857, and this is a play made 20 years later. And so you get all of these points of Buffalo Bill demonstrating this very negative, like him being the buffer between, you know, the American hero, the American way of doing things versus Latter-day Saints and others, you know, people deemed others. So you and then that goes into the 1880s as well. Actually, it might be the only letter that we have written in Cody's hand from the time he writes to a man named Vic Bierbauer, who he had become friends with in Western Nebraska, but he writes to him from England because he had heard that Vic had moved to Utah. And he's you know, ribbing him, giving him a hard time. He's like, you know, watch out for those Danites, and, you know, how many wives have you got now? And, you know, all these things that demonstrate his, you know, his understanding of Mormons as polygamous and violent people. The Danite trope is something that comes up a lot in Cody's plays and dime novels that, you know, that represent religious violence, and these Danites are positioned as that group that is the, they're the ones that carry out the violent acts at Brigham Young's direction. And so hopefully that gives you a bit of a sense for how negative he sees, you know, he sees, American culture sees, and the way his star and it grows and his persona grows, that he's embodying the antithesis of Mormonism, and he is this American manly hero that is showing America the way to, you know, to prevent Mormon threat from threatening the American people and the American home.
But and I'm glad you brought up the May Cody, because that was the area that I was going to ask you about, the May Cody and the Mountain Meadows Massacre. I'm glad that you brought that up. We don't need to bring it again, but it is an integral part of the story, because so much is focused on the negativity towards the church that's being shown in a public forum, that's being shown in his play, his performance to the public. Does the relationship though change over time? Does it, as you go further into the book and you go further into Buffalo Bill's life, does it begin to change to where all of a sudden they're starting to become a positive?
Yeah, so that is part of the evolution of the story, you know, to go from, you know, this very negative relationship, very negative perception, very negative portrayal by the 1890s. And I do think that there is something to the shift. It starts to be a shift in, you know, American perceptions kind of all the way around. But in 1890, the Latter-day Saints president, who was Wilford Woodruff at that time, makes an announcement, a declaration that Latter-day Saints would no longer moving forward from that point forward, no longer sanction plural marriage. And so, like, the end of future plural marriages allows for a space of acceptance. And I think you see that happening for Cody in 1892. It's towards the end of 1892. He meets up with a Latter-day Saint businessman named John Young. And John is talking about the great, beautiful scenery of southern Utah, northern Arizona. And Cody is, by this point, you know, one of, if not the most popular American celebrities of the day. And he's always looking for business opportunities. And, you know, this is a place that, you know, he starts thinking about maybe there could be a big game preserve or, you know, somewhere where he could bring people from Europe to show them the West. And so he agrees to go on this venture through the Grand Canyon and up through Utah. And John Young works with Junius Wells, who is a Latter-day Saint, a young Latter-day Saint leader, but he went out to Chicago to meet up with Cody and helped arrange and sort of lead, be like a tour guide of sorts for this adventure that they would take. And Wells wasn't the only Latter-day Saint that was a part of this, but he was, like I said, sort of the main leader of the trip. And they go on the train from Chicago. They stop at Cody's home in North Platte, and then they go on to Flagstaff, Arizona, and have a pretty, you know, romantic trip up through the Grand Canyon. And of course, you know, it's hard not to enjoy being at the Grand Canyon. It's such an incredible place and just beautiful. But, you know, they had their share of adventures and did some hunting and those kind of things. And I think having Wells be there and to have that personal interaction with him over the course of these couple of weeks as they're going on this trip. And then he gets to interact with sort of everyday Latter-day Saints as he and the company move up from the Grand Canyon to Kanab, which is a small, I would say Latter-day Saint settlement. I mean, it's a small town in Utah, but probably all Latter-day Saints, but, you know, maybe save a few. I guess I just don't know the exact demographics of it that time. I think of it as a Latter-day Saint settlement. And then up to Richfield, Utah, and then finally to Salt Lake City, where Wells introduces Buffalo Bill and his party to the first presidency of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And they have a very, what is described as a very cordial visit between these church leaders and Buffalo Bill. And after his trip, he's interviewed by Eastern newspapers and is asked, you know, what was the purpose of the trip and how did it go? And he talks about, you know, the potential for a big game reserve But also he talks at length about his interactions with Latter-day Saints. And it's a very positive report that he gives and that is then printed in the Washington Post, and talks a lot about how the Latter-day Saints are good, law-abiding people, that they are, you know, faithful people. But that idea of being good, law-abiding people after having been seen as these outsiders, these very negative, you know, polygamists who are very lecherous people, you know, especially the men, very lecherous, lascivious individuals. And now he's saying very publicly that these are good people. And that's a big shift, especially for somebody who has the star and stock of celebrity that the Buffalo Bill has. And so I see that as, you know, getting to know these people more than just their perception. You are spending time with them. You're in proximity with them. You're getting to know them and know their stories and to see how they really live. And he talks very openly about the things he saw, and he talks about it in a very positive light. And that's the moment, sort of the pivot point in the relationship. And then the next year is 1893, the Chicago World's Fair, major event in, well, for that year, but also that, you know, in American history, and to celebrate the greatness of America on a world stage. And Buffalo Bill, of course, introduces his Congress of Rough Riders and has a very large spectacle at the Chicago World's Fair that season. And he interacts again with Latter-day Saint leaders who are there. So Latter-day Saint leaders, Wilford Woodruff was there, and his first presidency, as well as many others who are, you know, using this venue as a way to talk about the positives of their faith, to let people, again, to see what they're really up to in the West. And one of the things that's on display in the Utah building that, you know, talks to Latter-day Saint industry and Latter-day Saint, you know, work ethic and things like that is the irrigation works of, it's a canal that's talked about, from that's built in Utah, and to kind of show how this canal has watered, you know, how many tens of thousands of acres of land to allow for these arid lands to be productive. And that's something that becomes a real key for Buffalo Bill, in the years to come after that. And so, you start to get this positive momentum happening in the early 1890s.
So, I had to get up for a minute real quick.
So, it's okay if I'm putting you to sleep, Mike.
No, you're not putting me to sleep. I had to get up. I had to stand up. My leg went to sleep. We're talking to, in case you're wondering who we're talking to, we're talking to Brent Rogers. He's written a book called Buffalo Bill and the Mormons. It's out now at booksellers near you. You can find it at Amazon for $29.63. It came out in March 2024, 312 pages, a bunch of photos, and you're going to want to get this book and read about it, because it is an important part of American history. We got just a few minutes left. I wasn't going to ask this question of you, but now I'm thinking I'm going to. My regular listeners, they'll be like, oh, here it comes. If you could get in a time machine and go back in this period while all of this is happening, go back to a point in time, see it with your own eyes, but not be involved, not get involved. You can't do anything about it, but just see it. Where would you go and why?
Well, for this history in particular, I think, can I get two answers?
As long as you can make it, all right, make I'll it done in 5 minutes. You can give two answers. Sure.
All right. So I would go back to two places, and they have to do the same thing. One is July of 1857 to see if Buffalo Bill really did go on the wagon train that left Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, to go and fight the Mormons in the Utah War, because that's a part of his story that he tells. And there's very little evidence, and historians have largely concluded that he made that up. But that question of, you know, why he made that up or whether he was there or not is actually a major a part of this whole story, because this is the part two to my answer is, in February of 1900, when Buffalo Bill meets with a group of Latter-day Saints up in Northwest Wyoming, he talks about being on that wagon train, and the Latter-day Saints that are there asking him questions about what it was like to, you know, fight against the Mormons I'd want to be there to listen to that sort of repartee, as a discussion, because from the accounts, it seems like, you know, Buffalo Bill is really, you know, giving them stories about what happened and what it was like to eat mule meat as they're, you know, as they're about ready to go fight against the Latter-day Saints. And the Latter-day Saints who were there in 1900 are, you know, some of them have familial connections to that time period, but they seem to be enjoying the storytelling. And so I see this as this moment of reconciliation, you know, reconciling the differences of the past to move towards a shared present and future. And I would have liked to be at that meeting to see sort of how that camaraderie came about, because after, you know, during that meeting and then after, but during the meeting, Buffalo Bill offers the Latter-day Saints that are there, you know, a tract of land and water rights to come build irrigation infrastructure in Northwest Wyoming,
right.
Because he's really interested in building up this region and he's struggling to get irrigation and other infrastructure that's necessary for urban growth to happen in the area. And, you know, by this point, he sees Latter-day Saints as having the model, the blueprint for producing and creating this type of, he keeps calling it a pioneer's paradise, but a place where you can be in the West, but have like the infrastructure necessary to have a nice growing urban population as well. And so looking at the example of Latter-day Saints in Utah and how they made, you know, the desert blossom as the rose is what he wants them to come help him do in Northwest Wyoming. And then, you know, there's a lot of history that happens from that point forward. And so I would have liked to be at that meeting to see how all of that discussion and conversation and camaraderie emerged. And then I think those would be the two things that I would be most interested in being a fly on the wall for as it pertains to this story.
Fair enough. I give you two. You're the first person I've ever given two. Normally they only get one, but I'll give you two.
Well, thank you for indulging me.
Absolutely.
I think they work together, though, right?
Yeah, they work together. So we're talking to Brent Rogers. He has written a book called Buffalo Bill and the Mormons. You can find it. Booksellers near you, including Amazon, for $29.63. It was published by our friends at University of Nebraska Press. Thank you, Sarah Key, as always, for the recommend. It's a wonderful cover on the book. Got a picture of Buffalo Bill on it. Cody, you're going to want to get this book. The book that he sent is a soft cover. I like a soft cover book over the a hardback. But again, it's Brent Rogers, Buffalo Bill and the Mormons, published by University of Nebraska Press. As always, you can find my podcast everywhere. On iHeartRadio, Podbean, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Spotify. You can find everything that you need as far as social media. You can find Cochise County Travels on Facebook, Instagram and YouTube. I'm narrowing down my YouTube channel to just Western History. So if you like YouTube, there's a bunch of little short videos in there, my travels throughout the American South, actually through America. I just finished a trip to Georgia and visited a whole bunch of Doc Holliday locations. And you can find that at YouTube on Cochise County _travels. Also want to thank everybody at Tombstone Epitaph at tombstoneepitaph.com, the Wild West History Association at wildwesthistory.org, and the BTK Coalition, all things Billy the Kid at btkcoalition.com. You got about a minute. Do you have anything you want to add? You got anything new coming out that you're working on?
No, I don't. Not anything in the, you know, in the next few weeks or anything. Just still trying to enjoy Buffalo Bill and the Mormons. I guess I just add that I'm grateful for this opportunity. Thank you for sure. having me on, and it's been a lot of fun. And I hope, you know, that people who choose to get the book will enjoy it. I think it's a good read.
There you go. I think it's a good read. It's a good read. It's extremely detailed. Some places I went back and reread twice. The May Cody stuff was very interesting. I'm at the transition point to where things are starting to get positive between Bill. I was really interested in the infrastructure because I'm in the construction business. So I was very interested in the canal building and the infrastructure. And like you said about how Bill was wanting to grow a certain area and he turned to the church for help with building the canals and getting water. I thought that was very interesting. So there's a lot of cool stuff in this book that you're going to want to read and then make this part of your library for all things Buffalo Bill and allow to go back and reread it again and get a better understanding. Again, this is Brent Rogers. His book, Buffalo Bill and the Mormons, is out now from University of Nebraska Press. You can find it on Amazon for $29.63. As always, please leave a rating and a review and a comment. If you're on any of the other spots like Spotify or iTunes, please hit the follow button and leave a rating and review. It totally helps with distribution. As always, I appreciate you. Appreciate everybody a bunch, especially Sarah Key over at University of Nebraska Press. As always, folks, thanks. Thanks a bunch. Safe travels, and we'll see you soon.